May it please the court. In this particular case, the state did not raise the issue of timeliness in the circuit court. The state did not even raise the issue of timeliness in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, in its decision, raised for the first time the issue that the motion was untimely.
And that's not uncommon. There are historical
That has happened before, yes. However, we submit that this court should neither permit the state to raise untimeliness for the first time on appeal, or that the Court of Appeals should be allowed to dismiss the motion based on an untimely pro se filing, because under the precedence of this court, the time limitations should no longer be perceived as restrictions on a court's jurisdiction.
What case do you have for that?
Under JCW X Rel Webb versus Wickascala.
That's just the general case about what is jurisdictional. Is there prior precedent out of this court that has found the timeliness requirement has any jurisdictional component? I know there are Court of Appeals cases that have said, well, if it wasn't timely filed, it was
jurisdictional. Well, under McCracken, this court said that if a matter is not jurisdictional but rather a procedural matter, then it generally may be waived if it's not timely.
McCracken also involved a civil case where an answer was required to be filed.
That's correct.
It's clear that under the rules of civil procedure that would have been required to be raised. But my question, I want to ask you the same question that I asked counsel, is jurisdiction aside, why shouldn't the plain language of the rules that says shall be filed within 90 days and shall be completely waived? I mean, it says it twice. Why does it necessarily have to be couched in terms of jurisdiction? If it says it shall be filed and it says it shall be waived if you don't file it, why isn't that enough? Why do we even have to have this discussion about jurisdiction?
If you're going past jurisdiction, again,
well, I'm just looking at the rule.
Again, you get back to McCracken. If it's not jurisdictional, it's procedural and it can be waived.
But McCracken didn't have anything to do with a remedy or a relief that prescribed what you have to do, mandatory language, what you have to do to get relief, and what happens if you don't do it timely. McCracken didn't involve either of those issues.
No, it did not, but I go back to the case out of the Western District where they said that the statutes of limitation can be waived if they're not raised. If a person could be sent to prison
on a procedural matter,
I would think that a timeliness of a civil motion would be able to be raised if the state doesn't raise it.
But counsel, excuse me, this is not a statute or statute of limitations. It's a rule of our court.
It is a rule of the court.
Much like we have rules that you have 15 days to file a motion for a rehearing or for transfer to the Supreme Court when you get an unfavorable result at the Court of Appeals.
And I believe it's clear under McCracken and other cases from Missouri courts that limitations on relief can be ruled even if they are the rules of the court. The rules of the court can be waived if they're not asserted in a timely manner.
Can you give me an example of a case that says that?
There is Andrews versus State. That's 282 Southwest 3rd, 372.
And what rule is it speaking of?
It says the state's argument for dismissal of an untimely Rule 2435 motion was not an issue of jurisdiction and can be waived.
And that's the Western District, which
that is
it.
That is the
conflict.
Western District Court of Appeals, yes.
Clearly we have different analysis among the Court of Appeals.
Yes.
And we have the Western District taking one position and the Southern and Eastern taking another position.
That's correct.
I think the questions are going to the court, for instance, sets time limits for appeal, time limits for doing certain things. Are those rules that are the court's to make, and the court can sua sponte address,
yes,
dismiss something if they're not complied with, or is that something that the parties have to raise and can waive? Is it just different in kind, even if some rules, like for when you file interrogatories and things like that, may well be waived if they're not timely raised?
That's,
things that
that's
protect
correct.
The court's functions and finality and so forth are different in kind.
That's correct. And also, as point out, you pointed out notice of appeal times. The court will most likely issue a show cause order to show why it should not be dismissed.
Or you can file a motion to file for
time.
Out of time. You can ask for leave to file out of time, and those are sometimes frequently granted at the court of appeals.
Correct.
But I think the question is, we don't wait for the other side necessarily to raise that issue. The court on its own can raise that issue too. But that's other than the court's timeliness rules. I'm not sure of any situation where we allow things to be raised on appeal. But this is somewhat of a unique statute, that rule 24035 and 2915, and that it sets out specifically the what constitutes a waiver and what the effect of a waiver is.
Correct. I am unaware of anything else that is allowed to be raised for the first time on appeal other than, say, the time from the notice of appeal.
And is this analogous to timeliness, to the other timeliness rules, Supreme Court rules?
I believe it is.
And doesn't that work against you? If it can be sua sponte raised and it's a bar to proceeding, in other requirements for timeliness.
However, the party in those cases are given the opportunity to show that it was in fact timely by an issue of a show cause order. And the circuit courts in the post-conviction cases would still have the power to issue a show cause order and give the movant an opportunity to show that the motion was actually timely filed, or
but it's still
was
a burden.
It's
still a burden on the party who the record shows it's untimely.
Once the issue is raised, yes, the issue is
on. And it can be raised by the court.
The issue can be raised by the court, but they need to have the opportunity to show that it was either timely filed or that it falls under one of the exceptional circumstances.
But is that a shifting burden, that someone else has to raise it, and then they can rebut that?
I don't believe it's a shifting burden. It's just bringing the issue up to the...
And someone else says it's untimely, then you have the right to say why it's untimely or it is timely.
Correct.
So it's just the burden's on you then to show it after someone raises the
After the issue is raised, yes.
Mm-hmm. But here, are you saying that, I understood you to be saying in your brief that if it wasn't raised in the trial court, it can't be raised on appeal even by a show cause order?
What our argument is that it's not jurisdictional, and under McCracken, if it's not jurisdictional, it can be waived if it's not raised in a timely manner. And this goes to, and I think it supports the purposes of the post-conviction rules, because it will get this issue resolved in the correct forum, which is in the circuit court, in an early, timely manner, rather than waiting for the case to be litigated through the circuit court, brought up to the Court of Appeals, both parties draft and file briefs, and then the court finally issuing a decision saying, oh, none of that matters because it was untimely.
Counselor, are you familiar with these cases that deal with the issue about whether shall means shall?
I'm not.
Okay.
I don't understand.
Well,
I'm not familiar with them.
There's these cases that talk about whether shall means shall. It's something that I didn't learn until I was in my 40s and on this court, but
whether it's directory
or mandatory. So if it says shall and doesn't have a punishment for what happens, then that's supposedly directory. But if it says shall and it says what happens when you don't do shall, then it's mandatory. And and looking at those cases, it seems to me that the language of 2915 is mandatory. It says shall be filed within 90 days, and if you don't do it, it shall constitute a complete waiver. So I'm trying to figure out how, and I want to give you every opportunity to convince me that, that those time requirements are directory as opposed to mandatory.
I don't believe that our argument would change that. The issue needs to be raised in the movement, so the movement has an opportunity to show that it was timely filed or that it falls under the exceptional circumstances that have been carved out by the courts of this state.
If in fact
it is untimely filed, then it shall be dismissed. But the movement needs the opportunity to show that it was in fact timely filed.
And I guess my question is. I understand that you're talking about this in the sense of one party versus another party, but I'm sitting here thinking if you're the motion judge and you listen to both parties and you read the rule and you feel like it's mandatory and you have the jurisdiction to rule on the case and you feel like it's mandatory whether anybody raised it, why it wouldn't be error not to dismiss it. If the rule is truly mandatory as opposed to directory.
Well, it's mandatory if the motion was actually untimely filed under the rule, but the movement should have the opportunity to show, no, actually, this was timely filed.
But why wouldn't that occur during the course of the motion? In other words, let's just assume that the judge is not taking an active role at all. He listens to both sides. Assume the issue of timeliness was missed by both sides, both the counsel appointed and the state. Assume that nobody caught it but the trial judge or the motion court. And so the motion court reviews the evidence. He looks over the rule, and he reads the rule, and he thinks that it's mandatory that he dismiss it. Where did the motion court err there if the language is mandatory as opposed to directory?
Well, what the motion court should do at that point is issue a show cause order. Show why this should not be dismissed for being untimely and give the movement an opportunity to show that it was actually timely.
This is a unique situation because we have three cases set with the same argument. So,
correct.
So I'm asking you to respond to what occurred in the prior argument, which the state argued in that case that the case law is that the movement has the obligation to show that it's timely. So if the movement has the burden to show that it's timely filed, doesn't that solve the problem that you're suggesting, that the movement's caught off guard and they don't have an opportunity to prove to the court that it's timely filed? If they have the burden and they're required as part of their pleading and their proof, why doesn't that meet the problem that you're suggesting, that they wouldn't know they had to show that?
Many of the issues that would arise in showing that a motion was actually timely filed when on the face it may not appear so occurs after the movement mails his motion, after he gives it to the DOC post office. Many of the delays that would be not the fault of the movement occur after that.
He may not be aware
that there is even an issue until someone raises it. Say, well, this isn't timely filed, so he should have the opportunity to show, actually it was.
But he'll have a counsel appointed, and that counsel would have an opportunity, because that would be after the circumstances you're suggesting. So that counsel.
My suggestion is under the rules of ethics that counsel should not be raising this issue against the interests of his client.
What you're saying is that would then allow him, if he knows he didn't file it timely, to sit there and not raise that issue, as opposed to meeting his burden of showing it was timely when it appears not to have been.
If he knows it, I would suggest that he probably wouldn't know it. That
but
it was
his
untimely
counsel
that's
appointed would.
Well, at the same
You're saying it presents an
ethical dilemma. On the other hand, the prosecutor should know it too. they can count the days just as well as anybody else. And it would be easy for them to print off a form motion and file it with the circuit court to put everybody on notice that this is an issue, so it can be litigated at the earliest possible opportunity.
Thank you.
More questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to talk a little bit about the jurisdictional issue. I know after Webb against Wichiskala and McCracken against Walmart that it's probably crazy to mention the phrase subject matter jurisdiction in front of this court. However, I think that it's something that that can't be overlooked in this particular case. In McCracken and to a certain extent in Wichiskala, the court recognize that it still exists. Subject matter jurisdiction still exists. It's not been eradicated. The argument from the other side is that it's discredited, it doesn't exist anymore.
No, I don't think anyone suggests what the case has held, and I think everybody in all the briefs has addressed, is that it's a constitutional issue. Subject matter and personal jurisdiction are simply limited and they've been too broadly applied. No one suggested there's no such thing. Is subject matter jurisdiction.
Well,
I think all the cases recognize it has its very narrow limits, though.
The suggestion is it doesn't apply to this
right.
situation
exactly.
at all.
Right.
We know in the court recently in the case where the crime occurred at the post office, the court applied the concept of subject matter jurisdiction. In McCracken, the court recognized that still exists. And the citation the court made to a court of appeals case, Gunn against Director of Revenue. In Gunn, a petition for judicial review of an administrative action taken by the Director of Revenue was filed late. In fact, in the circuit court that had jurisdiction, would have otherwise had jurisdiction over the petition for judicial review, DOR confessed, and the circuit court entered a judgment setting aside the director's administrative action based on that confession. At the Court of Appeals, however, and I'm not sure if it was sua sponte by the court or raised by the director in front of the Court of Appeals, they dismissed the appeal or sent it back to the circuit court for dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, noting that when a court is engaged in the special exercise of a special statutory power that has strict time limits on it, the court only has the authority, or I guess the word would be power, since we're talking about jurisdiction, to act on that case.
I understand there was a general citation in McCracken, but that's exactly what Webb said. We can't go down that road. You run down this road where there are these quasi-subject matter jurisdiction issues and really so muddy the definition of what subject matter jurisdiction. You do, however, have the issue of authority, and I thought that's what most of our discussion today was. The fact that the court has subject matter jurisdiction doesn't mean necessarily it has authority to decide an issue.
But I agree, Your Honor.
You're taking on something that also Moore in the footnote, I believe, said that in fact this is not a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, but it may well be a matter of authority. So addressed it.
And the Moore footnote did say that.
Yeah.
In relation to basically a semantic issue, because the circuit court in Moore said jurisdiction, and the defendant in Moore was arguing that, well, that was wrong. It was, and the court basically noted, well, that's just authority. I don't think the court considered this precise issue that I'm arguing here, which is, I don't think the citation to Gunn and McCracken is, I think it's important because from a separation of power standpoint, if we look way back at the beginning of when there were administrative agencies and they decided basically cases brought before it, there was a tension between the executive branch and the judicial branch about the authority of the executive agencies to decide these matters that were within their rulemaking and within their domain versus the right to have some kind of judicial review over it. We have a constitutional provision that allows for circuit courts, for courts, to review decisions in contested cases by administrative agencies. Gives power to the General Assembly by law to establish those procedures. One of those procedures is, in most cases, it's 30 days. If you don't file a petition for judicial review within 30 days, it becomes not a matter of authority, it's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction.
And you're talking more about statutes more akin to like a statute of limitations. How is that different from our own court rules that set mandatory timelines?
Well, Your Honor,
or is there a difference?
I think it's not statute of limitations in the administrative procedure context. It is a mandatory obligation on the part of someone seeking to ask the court to review the decision of a separate branch of government that you have to do this within 30 days. Because just like in this situation with post-conviction, the finality of an administrative decision is important. We cannot have administrative decisions dragging through the courts or being brought up months or years later to be reviewed. The same thing is true. Go ahead, Your Honor.
But this is a court rule that we're looking at today, not a statute. Well, is there a difference?
Well, Your Honor, that's true. I don't think there is a difference. And we also have to remember 547.360, RESMO 2000, is a statutory codification of 24.035 and 29.15. So the General Assembly, and they basically mirror each other. So the General Assembly has a statute on this, and the court has passed a rule.
I mean, as I understand, I don't know why you're analogizing to the administrative cases, but clearly that person could file an action in circuit court alleging error in the administrative agency decision a year later, and it would be a complete defense that they failed to file it timely, but the court would have jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, over the lawsuit, and they would dismiss it because you failed to comply with the requirements of filing within 30 days. I'm not sure you're aiding yourself here.
Or
that it's an issue in this
case. Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree, because it wouldn't be, you file a petition for judicial review late. Just like if you file.
Can I interrupt you? Because
yes.
I think I understand what you're trying to argue. There is no question the court has subject matter jurisdiction over a 2915
right.
case. It is the type of case that can be heard. You're arguing something like standing or failure to state a claim.
Can I see if I understand? I think you're trying to say there's a difference between an affirmative defense and a statute or rule which creates a particular type of relief that at its outset has time limits, as opposed to a defense. So in the petition for administrative review, here's the relief. If you don't file it on time, you can never get the relief. It isn't that there's a separate statute of limitations. And you're saying that the enabling legislation or the enabling rule that creates this relief has time limits at the outset, not that it's a statute, not that it's affirmative defense.
And that's true. And those time limits, Your Honors, and I know that this may sound, the time limits give the court the subject matter jurisdiction to hear the case.
We don't need to decide those issues here, though, today, do we? As opposed to the question suggests if this court were to disagree with you, that's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. Do you lose?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
The court could not decide that issue. The courts are always obligated to recognize whether they have jurisdiction over a particular case or not. And all I'm trying to point out, and I don't do this lightly, I've thought about this quite a bit. When this circuit courts have jurisdiction over all cases, civil and criminal. A petition for administrative review, and I believe just like a motion for post-conviction relief, is neither a civil or criminal case, as those phrases or those terms are understood at the time the Constitution was adopted. McCracken involved tort. Clearly, subject matter jurisdiction, courts have always had subject matter jurisdiction over that. Wichiskala involved dissolution proceeding. Another clear-cut case where courts for decades have had jurisdiction
so
over those.
So you would say statutes can be passed that can take away this court's subject matter jurisdiction that it otherwise would have by calling something a motion or whatever. I mean, the whole point of Webb was that this court has constitutional subject matter jurisdiction over all cases that are filed before it, and that can't be modified by statute. And you're trying to suggest, well, it can if we call it a motion or something. I mean, we still have jurisdiction. It may be we have non-waivable authority, you know, limits on our authority.
Well, you could call it that. I really do believe that it involves subject matter jurisdiction because the court has no inherent authority. And I go back to the administrative example. There's no inherent authority of courts to consider petitions for judicial review from administrative actions. And that was the problem which led to a constitutional amendment. To do so really would involve a separation of powers argument between the executive branch and the judicial branch on the authority to do that. We have a constitutional provision that allows for it. It allowed the General Assembly to make the laws governing it. When they put in that time limit, and this court in
Judge Fisher's question was going to this, that there may be, if it may be a matter of semantics, so put aside sort of that language for a minute, are there certain things, clearly there are many things that can be waived if they're not timely raised. Subject matter jurisdiction is not one of them. But is there an in-between category that this court under Webb would not call subject matter jurisdiction? I understand you would, and yet it's not waivable, even though it's not a subject matter jurisdiction matter.
Well, I think that the post-conviction rules are exactly that group of cases, I guess.
So how do we define that group, and is it appropriate to muddy the waters, or is there some clear definition and clear contour of those things which are not waivable even though they're not subject matter jurisdiction? Well,
and I don't think calling it subject matter jurisdiction is muddying so much. I understand the Court of Appeals got way far afield with jurisdictional competence and all that. I understand that, but you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Subject matter jurisdiction is still, and I go back to the citation in McCracken to Gunn. In Randles against Schaffner, Cullen against DOR, this court held that a petition for judicial review filed one day late, even just one day late.
Those were all pre-Webb cases, right?
Those were all pre-Webb cases.
Doesn't the court have inherent authority to require its rules to be followed? And if we have a rule that requires a 2915 motion to be filed within 90 days, don't we have the inherent authority to require our rules to be followed?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, and I.
Isn't this what this case is about?
And that's what this case is all about. And they have the burden of pleading and proving the timeliness of their motion. In our brief, we cited Jones against State, 2 Southwest 3rd, 825 from the Eastern District, that basically says that it's always the post-conviction movement's responsibility to plead facts showing the timely filing of the post-conviction motion. The burden's on them throughout.
Plead facts, it doesn't mean prove them, it just plead. It's like statute of, it's just like filing a tort case and assuming it's within the period of statute of limitations, then someone else has to say it isn't.
Well, if there's an issue of timeliness, they better put on some evidence. This is very simple. There's a date stamp on the pro se motion. There's a docket sheet showing the date it was filed. You add up the days. If it's past the number of days, you better be putting on some kind of evidence that it was timely filed or there's some excuse for it.
Your opponent argues that and the prior public defender argued that places them in a position of presenting a position contrary to their client's best interest by even recognizing the record shows it's late. What's your response to that?
I don't understand that argument. If it's your burden to plead and prove a specific fact, I don't understand that. Then you do it. And ignoring it, hoping that no one will notice, is just not, I don't think the ethical rules require that whatsoever.
Judge Clayton, do you have any questions you'd like to ask?
I was going to ask if that's what you're asking. Basically, it sounds to me like you're suggesting an additional element that would have to be proved for the motion court to make a decision, that they have to make that affirmative statement on the timeliness of the motion. So if that is pled or that is stated and they prove it up and then it later finds out that maybe it wasn't accurate, could the prosecutor then bring up timeliness as an issue at the appellate level?
Yes. I think
so. Even if it's proven up at the trial court level and then something comes up later on, you'd have the ability to raise it again, even though you didn't raise it at that time?
Yes. And I'm not sure what Your Honor is referring to when if something came up. We don't present evidence at the appellate level. I can't bring in something new today and say, hey, this was untimely. That record is made before the circuit court. It is the defendant's obligation to make that record. In most of these cases, it's very clear from the face of the pleadings, is it timely or not timely? There may be situations where something went awry, you know, it didn't get filed when it was delivered, and that can be handled at the circuit court.
What if the state were to concede timeliness at the trial level? Couldn't you then raise it again at the appellate level?
I say the interest in finality of criminal judgments and the way that the PCR rules are written, I don't think a prosecutor or the state can concede the timeliness of a PCR
so
motion.
So you're supposed to put on evidence on a conceded issue, regardless. Every case you better be really careful and get in all that evidence regardless, even if it's conceded it's timely. I mean, that's just, is there any other situation in all of our cases and all of our case law and all of our types of cases where you have to put in evidence on a conceded issue or you could lose on appeal on it?
Not that I can think of, other than in the administrative context, that you can't concede subject matter jurisdiction. You can't concede the timeliness of a petition for judicial review that's not timely.
Factual issue.
What about the post office case that you mentioned in your argument? In that case, it was basically conceded that the state had jurisdiction. Nobody raised it, and then several years later, it came up.
We can never confer subject matter jurisdiction. That's right.
Right, and that's a sovereignty issue. I think the separation of powers I think it's a separation of powers issue, and the authority of the court. Is it all cases, civil and criminal? You have to look at those words. They're just not empty, meaning that every single case that's filed, no matter how frivolous in a circuit court, that the circuit court has subject matter jurisdiction over.
Do we have to call it jurisdictional for an appellate court to act if it is not raised at the lower court?
No, I don't think this court has to. I think that these PCR rules are such a different animal than anything else that courts see, that the court could just make a decision, a bright line decision, that anything filed past the deadline cannot be considered by a circuit court, and that matter can be raised at any time, because these time deadlines are vital to the efficacy of these rules to be able to do what they're supposed to do. Barring that, there's habeas. And normally, and I apologize, I know I'm going way over, even on appeal, a lot of times an appellate court will issue an order saying, we don't believe we have jurisdiction, you have so many days to respond to it. Even at that level, there is a way for information to be imparted to the court if there's some issue about timeliness that's not recognized in the record itself.
No need for apology. You were responding to questions by the court. Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Could I ask a question before you get started?
Certainly.
Has your client indicated that you believe it was timely filed?
In this particular case, there's no indication of that.
So that's not an issue in this case?
No, we're merely arguing the legal issue in this particular case.
Does your client have a remedy if he's not successful in this proceeding today? Is there any other remedy for him?
I don't believe so.
Is habeas available?
Not on the issues raised in the PCR, I don't
know.
Now,
the Court of Appeals decided this case.
Correct.
Did you have any chance to respond to the Court of Appeals?
No, we did not.
So if it was
they simply remanded
the trial
it for
level,
dismissal.
If it was raised at the trial level, you could have responded.
We could have responded and presented evidence if such
but
existed.
But you're saying in this case there is no.
I'm unaware of any. Yes.
Yeah, and it would benefit your client if there were evidence that you would know that.
Correct. Post-conviction cases are ruled by the civil rules of procedure. This court has subject matter jurisdiction over post-conviction cases. However, as this court stated in Moore v. State, that's 328 Southwest 3rd, 700, the time limitations under the post-conviction rules are no longer perceived as restrictions on the court's jurisdiction. And as this court stated under McCracken, if it's not jurisdictional, it's procedural and can be waived.
But McCracken wasn't dealing with this particular fact situation. It made the broad
Correct.
Statement that usually in the normal case, things are waivable, as indeed they are. But I think Judge Russell asked, aren't there some things that this court sua sponte has the right to, an inherent right to enforce its own rules?
This court does have the inherent right to enforce its own rules. And if there is a question of timeliness, the appellate courts, this court, can remand it back for a hearing for a determination on
so
the timeliness.
So you're saying if the Court of Appeals is going to dismiss on a timeliness issue such as this, they should issue an order to show cause and give a chance, or remand back for a finding on timeliness if there's factual issues?
Correct. Because to give the movement the opportunity to show either that it was actually timely filed or that it falls under the exceptional circumstances that have been carved out by the courts.
And now, in Moore Automotive versus Goffstein, a well-written decision, I might add, and there was a assertion that you shall answer the interrogatories. But we decided that didn't really mean that because I guess it was more directive than mandatory. So do you have any, do you recall having researched Moore Automotive versus Goffstein?
I don't recall that case, but I don't think our position changes the word shall in the rule. It just merely allows the movement the opportunity to show at the earliest possibility that it was actually timely filed or falls under an exceptional circumstance.
Your position would require this court to find that the state has the burden to show it's untimely, or the court does, that you don't have a burden to show it's timely.
No. Our position is that the state has the burden to raise the issue.
But if you have the burden to show that it's timely, you then have an opportunity to present any facts or any issues, and you'd have to do that in the motion court because that's where you have your opportunity to show it, and that's where you have your burden of showing the right to relief.
If it has been if you're on notice that timeliness is an issue.
But you're on notice that timeliness is an issue because you have the burden to prove that it's timely.
We have the burden to show that it's timely, but if we don't know that there is a question about that, we won't know to present any evidence.
Well, didn't you file a motion for rehearing at the appellate court that's setting out those facts that would show that it was timely?
That is possible. But the proper venue for putting evidence on the record would be the circuit court. That's why it should be sent back to the circuit court for a hearing on this issue.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.